That's why I like a clock that can't tell time. Okay. In the evening classes of late, we've been discussing personalities from Ramayana. And the context for this is pretty nice. As you, I'm sure, know, for 30-something years, 35 years, I've been conducting visits to holy places with groups of devotees. And the last two places we went were Ayodhya and Chitrakoot, and then the Aranyakanya Kishkindakanda. And I had never been to those places, but it was a very nice experience. And I hadn't been at all familiar with Ramayana. I mean, little, but very little. And it's a nice experience becoming more familiar with Ramayana. And when we were in those two visits, there was a number of Chinese devotees with us. I'll just share one thing that's really, really nice. In the group of Chinese devotees, there was a young lady, probably in her early 20s, and I was just curious what their experience was. And they were going around the room, you know, through a translator. She started crying and saying, this good experience, that good experience. And I've always thought of China as my home, but now I'm taking away, I really want to be in my real home. It was from her heart that was being said. See, I want to find that place that's my real home, and I'm feeling connected. So I understood that because the Chinese devotees don't have Ramayana in Chinese, they pick up pieces here and there, but rather than retelling the whole Ramayana, just focus on personalities from Ramayana and let them put the pieces together. And part of that was from one of the GBCs for China, Chandrasekhar Prabhu, who's from Australia, but he speaks Chinese as well as he speaks English. And he said, as you know, Maharaj, the theme for the motto or the mission for our the China mission is Krishna consciousness with Chinese characteristics. KCCC. Because everything's got to have an acronym, right? So, in keeping that theme, you can invite some of the local Chinese devotees to come up with historical or literary personalities from China's history or literature that resemble these personalities, the profiles of these personalities. And then even suggested who could be the coordinator for that activity. So that's what we're doing. This is a warm-up. That is, I'm gathering from different sources information about different personalities. And this evening is Valmiki. It may be a good idea to start with Valmiki. I'm not sure. There is a lot to say about Valmiki, and I'll begin with something that I'm not going to do this evening, but one of the reasons to not start with Valmiki is because it may be confusing right off the bat that there are multiple Ramayanas, and that there are multiple Ramayanas kind of makes my head spin. Like, will the real Ramayana please stand up? You know that one. So, when I, as a young Western person growing up in Krishna consciousness, I only knew one Ramayana, Valmiki Ramayana. Then I came to know that there's another Ramayana that's very popular, but there are some, Prabhupada said, there are some parts of it that are explicitly non-devotional, meaning Ram is a manifestation of the impersonal Brahman, explicitly, in one of the popular Ramayanas. And he advised that we don't read it, but it's still very popular today and in the world, in India particularly, in North India in particular. But then as I went on further, there's multiple Ramayanas that are recognized amongst, you know, the authorized lines of acharyas. Besides commentaries on Ramayana, the commentaries upon Ramayana are largely very strict to adhere to Valmiki Ramayana. And there, for example, there's things in common speaking about Ramayana that are not in Valmiki Ramayana. One of them that's very common is Lakshman Rekha. It's not in Valmiki Ramayana. You know what that is, right? I'm looking at you. Yes. Lakshman Rekha, you heard that one? When Ram goes to get Maricha and Sita says what she says to Lakshman, oh, didn't you hear that? Ram's voice calling for you and for me. So he made a mark with his bow and said, don't step outside this mark, the circle, Lakshman Rekha. And then she stepped outside the circle, and that's when Ravana captured her. That's the reference. You've heard that story, right? Okay. The point is, it's not in Valmiki Ramayana. Or another that's not in Valmiki Ramayana, but is often celebrated, is the place on the southern tip of India where it is said that Ram worshipped Lord Shiva, a Shivalinga. It's not in Valmiki Ramayana, but everybody knows it. Everybody knows the story. And then there's questions about, you know, why did Ram worship Shiva and all that stuff. But when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu made his South India tour, that is one of the places he visited. You know, let's say indirectly acknowledging it's a legitimate place. So it's not in Valmiki Ramayana, but it's in other of the Ramayanas. So I'm going to give you a description. So I have to do a little bit of that with the Chinese devotees, but I'm going to give you a little description of different versions. And there are different versions of Valmiki's appearance. And now one of the ways to digest that there are different versions is there are different yuga cycles. In different of the four yuga cycles, Ram's appearance may slightly vary, Sita's appearance may slightly vary, Valmiki's appearance may slightly vary. It's not fiction. They do a creative writing spree and come up with a different way for the Lord to appear or his associates to appear. It says different yuga cycles, and there's variations on the theme. Prabhupada's explanation of that is, variety is the mother of enjoyment. You've heard that one? Variety. So, as that holds true for us, where we get it is true for the personality of Godhead, and he appears in different ways. It's quite amazing. There are about five or six different narrations of Sita's appearance. Excuse me, Radha's appearance. They're distinctly different without going through all that. But that's how it's possible. It's not made up. Different yoga cycles. So with that in mind, Srimad Bhagavatam, of course, is our, along with Valmiki Ramayana being the gold standard amongst Ramayanas, Srimad Bhagavatam is, for us, the Amala Pramana, the spotless evidence. And in Srimad Bhagavatam, it speaks of Valmiki's father being Varuna. Varuna, according to Srimad Bhagavatam, has two wives. Urvashi was kind of like one of those celestial damsel relationships. And from combination of Varuna and Urvashi, Vashishta, very celebrated personality, Vashishta appeared. And Varuna was lawfully married to Charshni, his wife, and there were two sons, Bhrigu and Valmiki. And Shaunaka, who's this, the what speaker in the, Shaunaka is the son of Bhrigu. So here's the description. From Lord Brahma, this is Srimad Bhagavatam's version. From Lord Brahma, there were seven mental born from his own body sons who were Prajapatis. One of those Prajapatis was Marichi, distinct from Maricha. Marichi. And Marichi had a number of sons, one of whom was Kashyapa. Kashyapa. And Kashyapa married 13 daughters of Daksha. This great sage Kashyapa lives in the northern side of the universe. So that's where the Sapta Rishis are, in that realm. That's the northern side of the heavenly region. It's the vertical dimension of the universe. So, from Aditi, one of the 13 daughters, became the Adityas, and one of whom was Indra, and then another is Vamana, younger brother of Indra. It lists them. Here's, you would like to know who the 11 Adityas are. Vivaswan, Aryama. We hear about Aryama because he's in the abode of Yamaraj. And when Yamaraj vacates, Aryama takes over. Then he goes back after when he becomes... Pusha, Tvashta, we hear the name Tvashta in the story of Vitrasura, right? Tvashta. Anyway, the wife of Varuna, who is the ninth son, son of Aditi, was named Charshani. Charshani. So, Bhrigu was, there's Bhrigu part one and Bhrigu part two. Bhrigu part one died being cursed, and he was born Bhrigu part two as the son of Varuna. So here's the verse 5 from Canto 6, chapter 18. This is the lineages of kings, lineages from the personality of Godhead descending from Brahma. The translation reads, by the semen of Varuna, the great mystic, Valmiki took birth from an anthill. Bhagavatam. Bhrigu and Valmiki were specific sons of Varuna, whereas Agastya and Vasishtha rishis were common sons of Varuna and Mitra, the tenth son of Aditi. So Mitra was one of the sons of Aditi, and Varuna was one of the sons of Aditi, and Agastya and Vasishtha were born. That's like a very interesting story. Commentary, BBT, Prabhupada, writes, Srila Sridhar Swami writes in his commentary on the above verse, quote, both Bhrigu and Valmiki exhibited profound erudition and the super excellent qualities of Vaishnavas, hence they are called extraordinary sons of Varuna. Whereas Agastya and Vasishtha were Brahman-realized monist Mayavadis, hence they are known as ordinary sons of Varuna, Agastya and Vasishtha. Now Agastya plays a role in Ramayana as well. Now, as far as Prabhupada's purport goes on, in Bhagavad Gita 10:25, Krishna says, Maharshi nam Bhrigur aham, of great sages I am Bhrigu. 10:25, Bhagavad Gita, opulences of the absolute. In the purport, Prabhupada writes, Brahma, the first living creature within the universe, created several sons for the propagation of various kinds of species. Among these sons, Bhrigu is the most powerful sage. This Bhrigu is the first Bhrigu who participated in the Daksha Yajna, and he died as a result. Bhrigu's son is Shaunaka Rishi, who listened to Srimad Bhagavatam from Suta Goswami at Naimisharanya. Thus, Varuna's lineage plays a significant role in the dissemination of Vedic knowledge. His sons and grandson are key personalities in both Ramayana and Srimad Bhagavatam. The name Valmiki is given, or was given, or it means he who springs from an anthill. A white ants are Valmiks. Valmiki. In Uttara Kanda, the final section of Ramayana, Valmiki talks about himself by saying, I am the tenth son of Varuna, lord of the waters. Yet, in another section of Uttara Kanda, it says, thus was sung the Ramayana by the mighty son of Varuna. Brahma signified his glad approval. And just here's a whole array of who is Valmiki, what's his origin, and how does he fit into the constellation of, you know, the amazing history of Vedic culture and mankind. Govindaraja. So Govindaraja is a Sri Vaishnava commentator who lived some 8 or 9 generations after Jamunacharya and Ramanujacharya, but he wrote under the order of the Lord to compose a commentary, a summary of Valmiki Ramayana, or of Ramayana, based upon, and he did this by gathering what other acharyas in previous ages had written. So, in his commentary on the very first verse of Valmiki Ramayana, he says, Although countless years, all through the countless years, trees and shrubs sprang around him, while an immense anthill arose on all sides, completely concealing him from view. Later on, Varuna, the lord of the waters, sent down heavenly rains, which dissolved the strange tenement. Coming out of it, the gods hailed him as the son of Varuna. Doesn't explain. According to the Vayu Purana, Valmiki was Vedavyas. So, according to our Vedic teachings, each time Dwarapa Yuga ends and Kali Yuga begins, when there's that juncture, then somebody performs the service of compiling the Vedas and dividing them, the Vedavyas function. For example, in Vishnu Purana, Parashara Muni says that two yuga cycles ago, I was Vyas. So here it's saying, according to the Vayu Purana, we're in the 27th yuga cycle of Vaivasvata Manu. In the 24th yuga cycle of Vaivasvata Manu, Vyas was Valmiki. The next one after him was Parashara. We don't know who the one was in between. And then Krishna, Dvaipayana, Vyas. So it's a function that someone performs. So with all that background, I'm going to start reading because it's very complicated. From the Ananda Ramayana. Ananda Ramayana. It's a section of one of the Puranas. So it's a Puranic text that people accept. Our Vaishnava Acharyas accept, although it's quite different. Once upon a time, there lived on the shores of Lake Pampa a Brahmin, Shankha by name, journeying through the pathless woods that covered the banks of the Godavari, a fierce-eyed hunter sprang at him and robbed him of all the clothes, ornaments, water pot, and even the leather sandals of the unfortunate Brahmana. It was midsummer, and the sun was high in the sky. The sun's pitiless rays beat down upon the head of the poor Shankha. The red-hot sand burned his tender feet to the very bone. He folded the rags that the cruel, merciless hunter left him and stood upon them while the forest solitude resounded with his screams of agony. The iron heart of the hunter grew soft toward him. "I did the right thing," he said to himself, "in depriving the poor fellow of what he had, but it is exercise of my duty and hereditary calling. But let me lay some small merit by giving him my old sandals." So some service to the Brahmana. Shankha was profuse in his gratitude. "May all good go with you. Verily, it is some good karma of a past life that put into your head the idea of making me a gift of a pair of sandals to a poor wayfarer, and that too when he needs it most." The hunter was curiously affected with the prophetic words of the Brahmana. "Good sir, may I know what merit I have accrued in a former birth?" "Alas," replied Shankha, "the fierce sun almost melts my brains. My tongue cleaves from dire thirst. Is this a place to dilate upon old world stories? Take me to some cool shady spot where I may rest my poor limbs." A ray of pity illuminated the dark recesses of the hunter's heart. Gently he led Shankha to the cool waters of a lake, and the Brahmana plunged into it. He performed his midday prayers, offered due worship to the devatas, pitris, and sages. Meanwhile, the hunter busied himself in providing his late victim with sweet fruits and roots. Shankha partook of them and quenched his thirst in the nice lake. Then he sought the leafy shade of a hospitable tree, where the hunter followed him. Now I will reveal unto you some glimpse of your checkered past, said Shankha. So now it's a story within a story, and it's going to be a story within a story within a story. So he's speaking to the hunter, the Brahmin. Shankha says, there lived of old a Brahmana named Stamba of the Sri Vatsa Gotra. He lived in a town by the name Sala, along with his beautiful wife, Kanti Mai, a model of wifely virtues and wholehearted devotion. But the wayward heart of the man turned away from her, and he so forgot himself and the duty he owed to a lady and his wife, and instead brought home a prostitute. Stamba, that's the old Brahmin, Stamba was fully enamored by the smile of the prostitute. Although outraged, Kanti Mai remained loyal to her unworthy husband. She was most assiduous in attending to the comforts of the man and his paramour. She anticipated their least wishes, supremely content if she could thereby win back her husband's love. Years passed away. Stamba suffered the torments of hell even before he reached it, in the shape of a cruel disease that made his days and nights one long agony. The prostitute lady quietly robbed him of all the wealth he had and sought another, more congenial companion for her pleasure. Stamba came to know it, and his bitterness of heart called down the deadliest curses upon the prostitute and upon himself for having abused his wife's loyalty and love by saying, I stand alone in the world and helpless. I have willfully destroyed every chance of deserving any help from you or sympathy. My treatment of you is simply abominable. I placed the prostitute in the sacred seat of wedded wife. I rejoice to see the pure hands of my life's partner serve all meekly the unclean animal I had taken to my heart. Cruel were my words to you, and more cruel my behavior. The holy books tell us that the husband who brings the heart of his loyal wife, breaks the heart of his loyal wife, is doomed to the miserable lot of a eunuch for 17 births. But Kanti Mai lifted hands of appeal to him and cried, Lord of my heart, your handmaiden is ever at your service. She is yours to command now and ever. You shall not lack for any sympathy or service from my poor self. It is strange that you should feel shamefaced to ask it of me. Never did the slightest shadow of resentment darken my heart against you. As for what you say of my cheerless life, do I not know that I only pay back what I owed in my former birth? I made my bed and I must lie upon it. And when I was a dutiful wife, known to be otherwise than loyal and loving to her Lord, Forthwith she sped to her parents, and got from them the wherewithal to provide for his wants and necessities. The story continues. One hot day in June, Devala, the sage, crossed the threshold of the humble pair and requested hospitality. Kunti Mai turned to her husband and said, "This holy man is a master physician. I am sure he will relieve you of your cruel disease if he is so minded." Thus, she played upon his intense selfishness and unconsciously persuaded him to welcome the sage. She washed the scorched feet, his scorched feet, with cool water, placed a seat for him, fanned his weary limbs, and, when he had rested a while, entertained him with the very best her humble abode afforded. The water that washed his feet, she took to her husband and said, "This is a very potent medicine and will not fail." Stumba eagerly drank it in one gulp. At last, the disease ate into his vitals and he became delirious with pain. She procured some medicine and was trying to force it into his mouth when the man was seized with terrible convulsions and expired, biting off the finger of poor Kunti Mai. She sold her ornaments and jewelry, bought fragrant wood with it, placed her unworthy husband upon it, set fire to the same, and lay by his side in sweet content and supreme peace of heart. She reached the heavenly kingdom. But the dominating tendency of his life asserted itself at the last moment, and the prostitute was in his mind at his time of death. That Stumba was reborn as a hunter, and you are that hunter. The prostitute who was your partner has now been born as your wife. Since you consented unconsciously to welcome and entertain the Rishi Devala, a ray of pity, a flash of something noble, crossed your dark heart and induced you to relieve my sufferings and make a gift to me of your old shoes. The holy water that washed the feet of the sage has purified your unclean spirit, and you have been privileged to hear from me the details of your former life. In the last moment of your previous life, you bit off the finger of your faithful wife. Now you live upon the flesh of slain beasts. You died in your bed. Now the hard earth is your only bed. Now I will reveal to you what will befall you hereafter. Should I continue? He opened his eyes, he opened the eyes of the hunter to his next birth, instructed him in the right way of spending the holy month of Vaishakha. The hunter, now supremely repentant, gave back to his benefactor the articles which he had dispossessed him of, and saw him safely out of the dark woods. The unexpected turn thus given to his life was productive of very favorable results. In his next life, the hunter entered the semen of the sage Krindu, who spent many years in severe austerities on the bank of a beautiful lake. A serpent swallowed the semen of the sage Krindu, and the hunter took birth in its womb, in his next life, in the womb of a snake. This child, the hunter in his previous birth, was brought up by the rude hunters and took to their ways of living. He mated with a woman of the lower classes and had many children through her. He organized a gang of footpads, waylaid the travelers, and lived upon his ill-gotten gains. One day, the seven sages chanced to pass through the forest. Our Brahmin hunter, promptly held them up. "Revered sirs, none can pass this way without paying me a toll. It is my duty to collect the toll, as I have to support my wife and my young ones, so I request you to transfer all valuables that you may have." The Holy One smiled in pity and said, "My good man, please yourself, but do us a slight favor. Go home and put to your wife and children the following question." You know the question. "You share with me the gains of my calling, do you not? Well, will you take a share of the retribution natural to such a life of lawlessness and cruelty as I lead?" The sages said, "Fear not, but we will remain here even until you come back with their answer." And they bound themselves thereto by the most solemn oaths. The hunter could not clearly explain to himself what they were after. But such a simple request did not deserve to be refused, so he went home and put the question to his wife and children. But they laughed in his face and cried, "Are you mad? Who can deny that we have a right to share in your earnings? But to share of the results of your crimes, why, the very idea is supremely absurd." The hunter was dazed with surprise at this outburst of frank selfishness. The holy presence of the sages purified his nature and brought out its nobler instincts. So back he sped to where his strange visitors were. Tears of repentance and grief streamed down his rugged face as he clasped their feet and exclaimed in despair, "Lords of compassion, blind have I been until now. A life of cruelty and inequity did I lead, and went back upon the noble traditions of the Brahmanas to whom I belong by birth. I have run through the entire gamut of crime, and now I take my refuge in your mercy. Extend the shadow of your protection over me. I do not have any other person to help me." Then they took counsel among themselves. "Our poor friend is a Brahmana, as he is the son of sage Krinu, in a sense. But he has chosen to degrade himself and lead a hunter's life. Yet he seeks refuge in us, and it behooves us to do something for him. Let us try upon him the effect of the all-potent name of Sri Ram. He can have no better weapon to fight his past evil." They called him and said, "My good man, we instruct you in the mystery of a very powerful mantra. But as you have a long course of purification to go through, you cannot receive it as it is. We shall reverse it for you. Meditate it upon it with your heart and soul, day and night, till we come back." Then they whispered into his ear the syllables, "Mara," and vanished from his sight. The hunter planted his staff where they stood a moment ago and sat down there in all earnestness and in all sincerity began to meditate upon the mighty mantra. Many thousands of years passed over his head. The world and all it held simply slipped away from his consciousness. His various bodies were gradually purified of everything gross and material, and shone in their splendor and radiance. But there rose around him, where he sat, a large anthill that in course of time concealed him from view. The sages were good to their word. They came back to where the hunter disciple sat, lost in profound meditation. "Come out into the living world," they called. And he came out from the anthill. The sages laid their hands on his head in sweet blessings and said, "Holy One, the name of the Lord has consumed your past sins. You have stood face to face with a great mystery. You are our equal. A second time were you born. When you came out of the anthill, the world shall know you hence as Valmiki, son of an anthill." Some strains are similar, so certainly some parts are different. So here's another, here's an ISKCON devotee named Shubhavilas. You know him? Okay. So this is his writing, which is a little different, but it's similar to something that Srila Prabhupada told to George Harrison one time, describing about Valmiki Ramayana and Valmiki's appearance. One day, while on a wild hunt, Ratnakar stopped in his tracks when he spotted a saffron-clad sage radiating an aura of tranquility. Ratnakar momentarily forgot his purpose and began gawking at Narada Muni. A second later, he was back on track chasing the fleeing animal. Narada Muni spoke in a melodious, soft voice. "Why are you accumulating so many sins by inflicting suffering upon the innocent? Don't you understand the law of karma? Every sin that is committed is definitely going to fructify in the form of future suffering you have to undergo." The voice froze Ratnakar to a halt. Gathering his composure, he promptly attempted to justify his actions. "I do this with the sole aim of feeding my family." Narada Muni told him that if this was his aim, his family should be willing to share the burden of his sins. Ratnakar beamed, confident that his family members loved him enough to take the fall with him. Smiling knowingly, Narada Muni asked Ratnakar to validate his belief. Ratnakar rushed to his family and asked them if they would share the consequence of his sins. Their brutal response shocked Ratnakar. Crestfallen, he went back to Narada Muni. Ratnakar could now be helped. Prostrate at Narada Muni's feet, Ratnakar asked him to solve his dilemma. The fear that his sins would engulf him aggravated Ratnakar's anxiety, and he implored the Muni for guidance. Narada Muni offered a simple yet effective solution. He asked Ratnakar to chant the various holy names of Lord Ram constantly, but Ratnakar failed. Narada Muni realized that he was full of sin. However, he was not among those who gave up. He thought of a unique way to help Ratnakar chant. He asked Ratnakar to chant constantly the word Mara instead. This was easy for Ratnakar to repeat because his life was so closely connected with the word Mara, which means death. Ratnakar sat down instantly and began chanting Mara, Mara, Mara with complete sincerity. The chant created a word loop that magically transformed into Rama, Rama, Rama. Narada Muni's prescription suited Ratnakar's diseased condition. An advisor is like an able doctor who does not prescribe before diagnosing the disease. Days became weeks, weeks turned to years, but Ratnakar continued chanting Mara, never once getting up, eating, or even sleeping. Ants began to crawl all over his body and gradually made a huge anthill upon it. Besieged by ants, Ratnakar was almost invisible. Many years later, when traveling through the forest once again, Narad Muni stopped, for he thought he distinctly heard the Rama mantra emanating from somewhere close. He traced the humming sound to an anthill. The bewildered Muni sprinkled some holy water, and the anthill dissolved, uncovering a devout figure seated in a lotus posture, eyes shut tight, and lips constantly chanting, Rama. Ratnakar! Narada Muni gasped. Ratnakar opened his eyes to the soothing voice of his spiritual master. Valmiki Muni stirred out of his past and into the present. His eyes swelled with tears of gratitude on seeing his savior, Narada Muni. Soon, he was at his master's feet, seeking blessings. Narada Muni was so moved by his disciple's determination and virtuous appearance that he embraced Ratnakar and blessed him with a new name, Valmiki Muni, the sage who emerged from an anthill. Valmiki Muni could not thank his teacher enough for teaching him to praise Lord Ram by unceasingly chanting the supremely pure name. He now knew why he was chosen to write Ramayana. He's kind of blending things. Anyway. He now knew why he was chosen to write Ramayana. Narada Muni's forgiveness and mercy had armed him with unwavering strength for meditation and relentless chanting of the holy name. Chanting the holy name had purified him and spiritually elevated him enough to attract the mercy of Lord Ram. Lord Ram's mercy in turn presented him with the opportunity to serve Mother Sita. And it was Mother Sita's mercy that empowered him to write the Ramayana. Valmiki acknowledged, I am a product of mercy. And that same higher power used me as an instrument to compose the Ramayana. We just began the Purushottam month. Maybe some of you have thought of some vrata you want to observe during the Purushottam month. I know one devotee. I'll mention his name. I don't think he'll mind. Shamasundar, the temple president of the Houston temple. Before the Purushottam month, he had planned this for some time, but he resigned as the president and turned everything over to the next leadership. And then he made a Purushottam vrata of chanting 64 rounds a day for the entire Purushottam month. Now we do that sometimes, chant 64 rounds on a japa retreat day or maybe Krishna Janmashtami day or something. But to chant 64 rounds a day for a month, that's when your life has been busy like his life has been, raising two children, both wonderful children, now, you know, adults, but, and president of a temple. It's not, you know, you're kept busy when you're doing a service like that. So he's got that kind of capacity, and now he's directing that capacity to chanting. It wasn't like an all of a sudden, you know, from nothing to something. He had two brushes with death. Once was a brain hemorrhage, and another was something else that he had. It was, you know, like he was in the hospital. At any moment, he could just be gone. So Krishna's given him another chance he recognizes that way. And so he's been gradually increasing his chanting and his certainly faith in chanting and taste in, because you can't chant 64 rounds a day for a month if you don't have any taste. It's sawdust. You can't do that. So, but he has a taste. In fact, he sent me a text message saying, I'm sure he doesn't mind my sharing all this. He chanted 79 rounds the first day. When we have japa retreats, it's very common that he'll chant over 100 rounds a day. So I'm thinking of that. I was thinking of that as reading this. You know, he's not Ratnakar, but he is, anyone that chants a lot, something happens. There's purification that happens for sure. And what might be, for some persons at least, or at least at some time for all persons, something of a struggle to complete prescribed chanting by doing that and then some, there's some experience. There's an experience like this also with reading. I'll just share something similar. A dear friend, Bhurijan Prabhu, a Prabhupada disciple that we were classmates in college. He was 1 year older, but we knew each other. He has undertaken the service of summarizing the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. Some you may know, under his lotus feet is the first part, the first three cantos. And then the backward glance is cantos 11 and 12. Then he's going to cover the middle ones in course of time. But when he goes into a reading mode, it's minimum 6 to 8 hours a day. And his description is the first several hours is nice, but he really doesn't get absorbed until, you know, after that. The fourth hour, fifth hour, sixth hour. And it's not easy to focus the mind for that period of time. But when you can focus the mind for that period of time on the name or the Bhagavatam, there's some very special kind of purification. So it's not that you can't become purified unless you do something extreme like that. It's just appreciation. When that kind of dedication is made, however, whenever, there's some special experience in your relationship with Krishna. So his devotion to Narada, in this case with Ratnakar, and to the personality of Godhead, it's quite similar to any of our great personalities. And I'm most familiar with Bhagavatam. So like Dhruva or Prahlad, immense gratitude to Narada as their spiritual master and total absorption in the personality of Godhead. That's the fruit of Narada's association. So Valmiki had that also. He had fixed in his appreciation of Ram, his love for Ram, to the point of wanting to write and being empowered to write. So the introductory verses, in first initial verses we're going to cover now, this is Narada coming to visit Valmiki. This is the opening. And there is some description of the qualities of Narada, which are also the qualities of Amiki, but it's speaking of the qualities of Narada. So Narada is the spiritual master. One day, the sage Narada came to the ashram of Valmiki. By that time, Valmiki's knowledge of the Vedic conclusions was deep and profound. He had the fleeting senses and mind under perfect control. Narada knew no other joy than to contemplate the countless perfections of the Lord and of all the deep mysteries of the scriptures. With his veena, mahati, he sang melodiously the glories of the Supreme Lord, which enthralled the hearts of all gods and men. Very few equals had he in the art of speech. So clever and convincing he was. And so this is the first verse of Ramayana. Valmiki, the ascetic, questioned the eloquent Narada, foremost among sages, always devoted to austerities and the study of sacred texts. So the commentary is pages and pages and pages of taking each of the words. There's qualities or characteristics of a saintly person that are embedded in that introductory verse, referring to Narada, but equally applying to Valmiki. So that the characters are being introduced this way. And then comes Valmiki's question to Narada. And to him who came there, that's Narada, impelled by the searchers of hearts, Valmiki, respectfully submitted the following questions. So these are now 16 characteristics of a hero. So he wants to know. Among men of the world, who is the one crowned with every excellent quality? Who has mastered the science of weapons, divine and human, and out of might engendered thereby is able to scatter his foes before him? Who is versed in the mysteries of Dharma as revealed in the Vedas, the Smritis? He's asking, you know, to tell him the glories of Ram. And so he does in a summary way. Who is it that bears not in mind the grievous wrongs done to him by others, but magnifies any single act of kindness on their part? Who is it whose thoughts, words, and deeds are ever in perfect harmony? Who never strays from his dharma, even in the face of the dirtiest peril and distress? Whose life is pure and spotless? We're halfway through these 16 qualities. Who always seeks the highest good of humanity in this world and in the world hereafter, not only to higher ups but also lowly subjects like Guha, Shabari, etc.? Whose eyes see clearly and unerringly between the real and the unreal? Who has profound knowledge of men and things and twines himself round the hearts of all? Who is unique and a perennial source of delight to all that approach him? Who, like a skillful driver, has his mind and senses under perfect control? Who is it that allows not his temper to get the upper hand of him? Who is it of presence so charming that men may never have enough beholding him? Whose heart knows not envy, spite, and calumny? What does calumny mean? Calumny, I meant to look it up. Somebody look it up on your phone. C-A-L-U-M-N-Y. C-A-L-U-M-N-Y. False treatment. Huh?
False treatment.
False treatment.
Statement.
False statement. Okay. Calumny. One whose heart knows not envy, spite, and false statements. Who is that men and gods do dare not face when fierce joy of battle is upon him? Verily is almost hopeless to find all these noble elements combined in one single individual. But if there is one, you would know who it is amongst all men. For, O Narada, there is nothing either in the heavens or above, or in all the worlds below that escapes your all-seeing eye. Nothing would gladden my heart so much as to hear from your lips, if you deem me worth of the honor. Commentary says, these 16 attributes are attributed to the 16 phases of the full moon, and Valmiki is about to picture Ram as a pleasant full moon. That's coming up, I guess. Yeah. The emphasis in commentary has to do with, it's not just an intellectual exercise. It's a devotional mood. You know, to do what Valmiki did. He's not an ordinary person. This is this point of yearning. Some of you may have, heard or even participated in our Festival of the Holy Name. And the theme was say yes to the Holy Name. And the why part of the yes is yearning. And it comes up, it has come up again in the, this whole visit of Akura to go see Krishna. There's a yearning to see Krishna. It's an essential part of our life in devotion to Krishna. For us to go beyond, because it's one of those common questions, like how do I go beyond mechanical chanting? It's asked in different ways. That's a common question. And that, yet that spark that needs to be fanned is the yearning. So the yearning is in the question itself, how do I go beyond? But then you have to fan the spark. And hearing of the yearning of these great souls, here in this case it's Valmiki, or in the morning class it's Akura, we're hearing the yearning that they have. And of course they're far more elevated in that yearning than we are. We're sadhakas, and they're way beyond just being sadhakas. But there's a yearning. It continues. The yearning isn't like, okay, now I've yearned. What's next? It continues. It continues into the prema stage. We were discussing this morning. Was it this morning? Yesterday. I can't remember. Jiva Goswami is speaking of the intense yearning or tense enthusiasm, Lalasa Mayi. When was that? Today? Midday. Here? Local? Okay. So, it's right in Nectar Devotion. This is, you know, the practical application of hearing about Valmiki is this one. There's the yearning that doesn't go away. It yearning It sounds like the laulyam means greed, intense yearning. But it sounds like, you know, that's sad, or it's painful, or it's uncomfortable at least. There's something that is really important to you and it's just not happening. And one can get discouraged, or one can get distracted, or one can get all kinds of things. But if that stays, and you don't get distracted or discouraged, but it stays, then it carries one to the goal. That yearning then becomes, or can become, enthusiasm. It's not a negative emotion. I'm missing something. Boo-hoo. It's a spiritual power. So here we are. Valmiki has done what we heard he did already. And he has a relationship with Narada. That's what his relationship with Narada is. And he's still yearning to hear and to be in that relationship with Ram just by hearing. So he asked the right person. And he pushes Narada's button, and Narada just starts describing who the person is who embodies all these things at the same time. That only person is the personality of Godhead, or those so empowered by him to represent him in that way. And that's the eagerness of a spiritualist. And when that eagerness becomes awakened, then viraktir anyatracha, there's the detachment from so many things. The modes of nature act upon us all the time, conditioned souls. And to stay in the mode of goodness, the distraction has to do with the modes of nature. The distracted mind has everything to do with the modes of nature. And the mind that goes here and the mind that goes there. The planning thing. And anyway, it, you know, the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance. Never in the moment. Always somewhere. In the past or in the future, but never with Krishna. We're chanting or whatever. And the absorption is, you know, primarily the mode of goodness, and can be from there become transcendence. But the absorption is only possible when the modes of nature subside. Bhakti diminishes and extinguishes, has the potential to extinguish the influence of the modes of nature. It doesn't mean that a pure devotee doesn't act. I mean, to act, you have to think of what's next. I mean, just to get here to the house, there were lots of what's next thoughts. Otherwise, we wouldn't have gotten here. We'd be somewhere else doing something else. So, life of service to Krishna, it's purpose-driven, but it's not modes of nature-driven. As one approaches purity. So back to this point of yearning. We're not there yet. Or Valmiki is feeling he's not there yet. How elevated is he, and he's not there yet? So we don't be discouraged. You have a long way to go. Just stay in that bhakti mood and wanting to connect with Krishna. And why is it that we want to connect with Krishna? Besides, you know, somebody told me that's a good place to go. So getting some understanding of what Krishna's qualities really are, or in this case, Ram's qualities really are, or do it the other way. Here are all these wonderful qualities. Who matches up with all those wonderful qualities? Take it from either end of the spectrum, and the means of reaching the goal is like hearing Valmiki Ramayana. Hearing the goal is that this process of glorification and taking full shelter. therefore the acharya is describing, I like this part. There are different primary lessons or elements within the whole of Ramayana, but a major feature is elements of the process of surrender. Ramayana is a treatise on the process of surrender. There are different persons who are coming to the stage of surrender. Vibhishan and right here, Valmiki. There are those that don't also, but there are those that do. And Shabari and Guha and all the different personalities that take shelter of the personality of Godhead. And what that experience is like, what the obstacles, how they overcome the obstacles, opportunities that are presented, the empowerments that come. It's a really fantastic display of surrender to the personality of Godhead. I'll end with this. The Gaudiya orientation, followers of Lord Chaitanya orientation, is largely on the authority of Srimad Bhagavatam for various reasons. It's the spotless pramana and so forth. So when the process of bhakti is described, the personality who represents Atmanivedana of the nine processes of bhakti, one of them is Atmanivedana, and the person who displays full self-surrender is who? Bali Maharaj, Atmanivedana. In Ramayana, it's Vibhishan. It's a wonderful narration. I mean, who was his sadhu sangha? Vibhishan. Anyway, without going into all of that, because we've done it recently, the taking shelter with yearning and enthusiasm and eventually spontaneously just being there. The journey is a wonderful journey, and the resources to help carry us there are provided. And we just gather together and use those resources. It's in the COVID-19 times. I just got a text message in the morning at 6 o'clock this morning from Minneapolis. They're having a 24-hour virtual kirtan. It's not a, you know, it's, they don't even have a temple, but they're having association that way, and they're really enlivened. So I get, after that message this morning, I got a few others. They're really enlivened. So how do we can enliven one another? Who are we? We're little people. We can enliven one another by taking shelter of the name and the sound vibration of Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and here what we're doing is Ramayana, and it's enlivening. Some of you may more than know, you may be participating in, Nityananda Pran has a Saturday morning Ramayana class. And it goes on for an hour or an hour and a half. How long?
Mostly an hour, but just question answer, hour and a half.
So I spoke with him this morning, just after the class, his class, and, on my way to go to the 11:30 class. It ended. The topic today was just some inspirations that he has of late on prayers by Hanuman as he's offering prayers to Ram. And it wasn't like a whole class. It was just his meditation on those prayers, and then it was questions and answers. It says, you know, katayantashchamam nityam tushanti charamanticha. Just doing what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. So we may not be very advanced devotees. Well, it not may not be. We're not very advanced devotees. But we can derive happiness and pleasure by discussing topics of Krishna. I've become a really ardent appreciator of this reading groups. You probably know what those are. But in the last 2-3 weeks, I visited mostly homes of people that are really new, like that person we attended today, really new people. And they're they're coming from somewhere, you know, they have some idea of something, you know, some confused idea of something that has to do with Bhagavad Gita and spirituality and whatever. And they're finding, beginning people are finding a whole lot of strength just from systematically going through Prabhupada's books and association of others. They're discovering things that they're just like awesome. And it's helping to redirect the course of their life, and they're really happy. They're becoming, not like all the struggles of life just poof, they went away, but they're becoming happy. That they're, so, and how is, so what's the formula? It's katayantashchamam nityam tushanticha ramanticha. Just like we're doing. No, the more elevated is Valmiki asks Narada, and Narada responds, and he's ecstatic to hear the question, he's ecstatic to give the answer, and then from that he gets the empowerment to write Ramayana. He gets blessings from Brahma and so forth. So we're not ready to write a Ramayana, but we're ready to gather together and hear spiritual topics, especially from those who relish those spiritual topics. And even, you know, to whatever degree that's available, take it. And otherwise, with others, and you share with others whatever your capacity is to share with others. That's nice. That's going to enormously help purify the world. The world needs some antiseptic, not just a COVID vaccine. It needs some purification. So this is, we're taking the means to do that. Let's see if there's some discussion. I've kind of been blabbering on here a little bit too much, I think. Any comments? Anyone, anything? Go ahead. Nothing? Okay.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj, it's too loud.
You can, go ahead, you're good. Speak. He's just changing the volume.
Okay. Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. So Valmiki was Vedavyas, right? So he, even though he was born a hunter, he was able to write Ramayana because he was an exalted soul before, like in his previous births. Same way was Kaikeyi, an exalted soul as well. But for Kaikeyi, there would have been no Ramayana, right?
That's right. Well, it would have been different. Not no Ramayana would have been very different.
So, I don't know how to put this question. So why is all the Leelas beginning with one bad thing happening?
Well, it's not that the whole Vilas begins with one bad thing happening. There's a lot of things that happened before Kaikeyi did the bad thing. A lot of A lot of things happened. A lot of things happened before KK did what she did. Here's something from Govinda Raj's commentary. I like it. It helps answer your question. And in Valmiki Ramayana, and only in two places in the whole of Ramayana, does he use the phrase Yadrichchaya. Yadrichchaya has a funny translation somehow or other. There's no apparent cause. Just somehow or other. Govindaraj says that means Ram from within the heart of Kaikeyi inspired her to do what she did. It was a story changing, direction changing moment. And it was purposeful by Ram's arrangement. And there's multiple purposes that were served. One of them was to fulfill his purpose in coming to this world. Pritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chaduskatam. Because in the forest, there were sadhus. And the sadhus were eager for his association. So he was going to give his association to the sadhus in the forest. And that went on for 11 and a half years. And then there was another Yadrichchaya moment. Shuparnaka came and did what she did because that was a changing moment. So she did what she did, inspired by Ram to do what she did. So it's not that, but it's not that, you know, things don't happen until some tragedy happens. Some tragedy can bring a shift from, Prabhupada calls it reversal. You've heard that phrase, right? Reversal? It's a common phrase. You know, you're going this way, and then all of a sudden you're going that way. You're going along, da-da-da-da-da-da, the path of life, and something happens. And you're not going that direction anymore. There's this big surprise, and kaboom, and, you know, there's a calamity or a reversal. So, that results in status quo and shelters in the temporary are just dismantled, and that leaves shelter in one thing. For a Vaishnav, that's how it works. It's one of the ways that false shelters are removed to some calamity. Or, you know, the movement of the Supreme Lord starts moving in a certain way, but it can go in the direction of good fortune as well. So it doesn't have to be like that, but it just, by the Lord's arrangement, his Leela moves the way that it moves. And he inspires everybody, including Kaikeyi.
Thank you, Maharaj. One more question. So could I connect this with the eagerness becomes awakening? So Kaikeyi was eager to make her son the king, right? So that's how it all started. So could this be like an eagerness creating awakening?
Well, her eagerness was misplaced. Because, you know, transcendental eagerness is properly placed. Transcendental eagerness is the pleasure of the personality of Godhead. That's the eagerness of Valmiki. The yearning becoming eagerness. So, but people in this world, they're eager for something. If they're not eager for transcendence, they're eager for something. Because it's part of who we are, on the soul level. And then moved by the modes of nature, it goes this way, that way. Eagerness. Eagerness to go blow up the World Trade Towers. You know, that's another eagerness. But it's not transcendental.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So, Maharaj, this question is about hearing. So when, like I'm taking Vani association, Prabhupada has emphasized more on that. But I am by myself, it feels like, and distractions are there due to moods and everything. But when I'm in Vapu Association, so I feel that I'm protected and attention is there, and I'm not like in my general, like regular modes, but I feel very good that yes, this is what I want. So how, because it is not possible to always have Vapu Association.
Yes, right.
So how to go about that?
Grow in Krishna consciousness. By growing in Krishna consciousness means the bhakti principle isn't dependent upon what's outside. The bhakti principle is depending upon what's inside. And the modes of nature can gradually subside, will gradually subside. But you, one who strives by right means is assured of success. So you keep striving, but that's what to do. Until you, as you're on the path making gradual progress, distractions and all the other things that you just described, well, it's going to happen. Just accept. That's my condition. Let me keep moving. That determination comes from good association and quality hearing.
Yes, Maharaj. Like as you said, good association.
So sound. Means. Sound. Oh. Sound.
Yeah. I have one more question, Maharaj. So, right, like in this time of Corona, a lot of good lectures are going on. And
So many.
And I feel that this is really good and important for me, but I don't have that capacity because I'm trying to hear your classes, and other than that, then I feel that the topic is important, but I can't just. So, what is your recommendation?
Continue. When you're cleaning a pot in your kitchen, and there seems to be some stains that are stubborn and don't want to go away, what do you do? Throw it away?
No. Sorry, Maharaj, I couldn't understand because I was asking that other speakers. So I don't have that capacity of listening to other speakers.
Okay.
I feel that way.
Then so you don't have to.
Okay. Maybe the topics.
I wasn't clear what your question is. Now I understand better what your question is.
Sorry. So the topics seem to be very important, but
it's okay. You know, especially, it's recommended, especially, become very accomplished in hearing from one primary source or our founder Acharya and one primary source. It doesn't mean, you know, you're in a penalty box if you do something additional, but especially in the beginning, it's just like, you know, a child. Developing close relationship with mother and father.
Yeah.
And then that mother and father relationship is so important. Yeah. And as that important relationship grows, and then mother and father invite guests into their home, and the child comes to know this person that's come to their home is trusted, and you know, there's affection with mother and father, then they start to open to that other person. Like mother and father. Not the same, but like.
Yeah.
So it, you know, yeah. Same. Yeah. Same.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Any others? Do we have any questions online? Yes?
Maharaj, one more question, sorry.
Okay.
Is there any avatar of Krishna as a Shudra?
Any avatar of Krishna as a Shudra? Not
like
that,
Vamana as a Brahmana,
I know what
Krishna as a Yadava, and
well, lower than Shudra. How about, you know, a fish? How about a boar? But not specifically in the family of a Shudra that I'm aware of. Okay? Okay.
Online questions?
I'm ready.
Questions from Mahati Mataji. Is earning present in prema stage also?
yearning present in prema stage? Why not?
And question from Surabhi. How can we systematically, scrutinizingly study all this literature when there is so much to read? Srimad Bhagavatam has 18,000 verses. How can we do justice to all this unlimited nectar from our acharyas?
Little at a time. When there's a big feast, what do you do? Chew carefully. It aids digestion. That's it?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is something that kind of deviates from what you were talking about, but it relates to the Gajendra Moksha. I was just wondering, if King Indradyumna was meditating on the holy name the entire time, he ended up getting cursed to be born as an elephant and have to live a whole other life and struggle with his battle with Makara. So why did that happen?
Well, he wasn't meditating on the holy name. Your premise is he was meditating on the holy name. But when it's specifically stated that when he offered the stotras or prayers that he had chanted during his life as King Indradyumna, he doesn't mention who.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then it's said in the commentary, Vishnu knew, but Brahma and Shiva didn't come because they knew, although he didn't mention by name. He was describing the character and quality, but not the name. But Vishnu came, because he knew. Better to call the name. Either of you have anything? I thought so.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. It was so nice to hear about you mentioned about the president, about
Shamsundar.
Shamsundar.
79 rounds.
79.
And then he sat in an hour and a half in the garden.
Wow. That kind of sharing really inspires Maharaj.
Okay, so
we request you to share more. Actually.
Now, what are you going to do tomorrow with your chanting?
I'll concentrate my chanting, whatever I'm doing.
Let that inspiration go somewhere.
Sure, Maharaj.
Okay.
Maharaj, this question comes to me from this from the lecture, like Mara, Mara, Mara we had, right? Rama, Rama. The person who is not able to even chant, right? So the question is this way, Maharaj, like sometimes we are doing the process for quite some time, then we'll revisit and think, are we doing right, or
yes,
what
good.
Is that we are going to do? Okay.
Very good.
In that way, Maharaj, like when we are chanting, when I am chanting, right, like over a point of time, what happens is like I'm thinking, okay, I'm chanting and I'm hearing why I'm doing this. I want to purify myself. Then I'm questioning, it looks like a selfish thing what I'm doing.
Yes.
Yeah. So then I'm asking you, Maharaj, like what would be my mood? And also I'm asking you this, like when I'm chanting, if I think that I'm glorifying the God, I'm happy about it more than asking something of out of the chanting. So, yeah, that's my question, Maharaj.
It's not a question. It's you just did a fireworks. What's the question? So yes, purification, but for what purpose purification? If it's not for the pleasure of Krishna, because what makes Krishna pleased? And if you want purification because that will please Krishna, And without pleasing Krishna, you're not going to get purified anyways. So just make that connection. That's the bhakti principle. And glorifying the Lord, that's the bhakti principle. So whether it's this, that, or the other thing, the bhakti principle is the active principle that will carry you to Krishna. That is, anukulyena Krishna anushilanam. That should be. And it takes some time. It takes some refinement. It takes getting distracted and getting back on course. That's the lesson in chanting the holy name. Let's say, you know, the starting lesson in the chanting of the holy name is, it's all about Krishna's pleasure. It's all about our relationship with Krishna and pleasing him and serving him. That bhakti principle is most effectively awakened through and in the course of our chanting, if that's where our attention is going. The difficulty is the modes of nature, and we're going somewhere else with the modes of nature. They carry us here and there. The mind. And then, you know, everything else. Our life. We're under the grip of Prakriti. Influenced by the modes of nature. And that's what we're accustomed to and, you know, conditioned by. And we're trying to break free from that conditioning. So, pleasing Krishna. Sevan mukhi hi jiva dao svayameva sparatya da. You know the verse. Rupa Goswami. Service. Namadi, beginning with the name.
Yes, very much.
Okay. Anything?
No.
Your questions are always so good. Nothing this evening. Okay.
This question is from Jasmine Patel. How do we strike a balance with our family after hearing the story of Ratnakar? What's the mood with which we continue our both material and spiritual duties?
The language, you know, how do you strike a balance with your family? Well, you get a club and you bonk him on the head. Strike a balance. I was struck by the language. Strike a balance with my family. And it's, as far as the Ratnakar, it's not, the issue was the sinful activities and taking a share of the responsibility, the karmic responsibility for sinful activities. So, but that, you know, that's not a balance question. That's how do you live your life question. But the balance word is one of my buttons. And, you know, my response to the button push goes like this. It's not about balance. It's about Krishna consciousness. And like, you know, over there is something material and over here is something spiritual. How do I balance material and spiritual? Answer. There's not balance at all. It's time management. And I do this for Krishna, I do that for Krishna, I do that for Krishna. Now, many people, not everybody, a younger generation are going to have an opportunity to not, you know, do the balance thing. That is, everything is for Krishna. Before you have a family, it's really good to know that everything is for Krishna. And then family is also for Krishna. And so it's not balance. It's time management. This is what I do for Krishna this way. And this is what I do for Krishna that way. And this is what I do. So then you manage your time wisely. And there's never enough time to do everything. That's part of our experience, everybody's experience. So how do you deal with the things that you didn't get to do because there were too many things to do and you didn't have the bandwidth to do it all? That's another question. That's not the question that's being asked. It's don't see your family responsibility as something that's apart from your spiritual life. Your spiritual life includes that service with family. There's souls, parts and parcels of Krishna who you're serving, together with serving Krishna and coming closer to Krishna together. And then there's, you know, it's the holistic picture of the soul that has emotional needs, that you know, the coverings, the body and the mind. And there's needs and you work together towards directing those to Krishna as much as the individuals want to and are capable of. And, you know, be an inspirer to move in that direction as a family. And that's part of your service to Krishna. It's not balance. That's a shorter version.
Another question from Mahati Mataji. Are these scriptures, or are the scriptures only for people on earth or for the demigods too?
Oh yeah, the demigods have their version too. Bigger. They have big books. Ours are smaller. And some people think, well, I like reading books. Maybe I should go to heaven and read the books up there. I mean, instead of 18,000, it's 1,000,000. Let's go. Okay. Yes, last question. Yes, Amara.
I had a follow-up on this question that Mataji asked.
Which one?
About the family.
Balance, the balance question?
Not exactly the balance question.
Thank you.
But I wanted to just clarify that Srila Shukadeva Goswami, in the beginning of second canto, in the first chapter, he's saying that the people who are like family, just serving the family, and in the daytime they are laboring so hard.
This is devoid of Krishna conscious people. Yeah, okay.
So I just wanted to understand for myself that while serving the family, where to draw the line?
There's no draw the line. That's the same question. Excuse me for interrupting your question.
No, Maharaj, that makes sense. Yeah.
When Sukadeva Goswami is speaking in the first chapter of Canto 2, he's speaking of materialists. And as far as devotees, we work hard, but not for sense gratification. We work for Krishna. We're not idle. I mean, he would say it so many times, Prabhupada would say. And it's true. Who could keep up with Prabhupada? You know, 5, 10 young men couldn't keep pace with him. He'd wear them out. They have to like shuffle the youngsters to keep up with him. So it was not lazy. It was not an idol, but it was for Krishna.
So this is like for one who is aspiring yet to be a devotee. He's not even a devotee. So
well, you know, there's different stages, but the principle holds. Yukta Vairagya is the principle. You know the verse. So you're portraying yourself as a not very advanced devotee, and how do I, you know, handle? And the answer is you do for Krishna to your capacity, and manage your time wisely, and make sure you do this and you do that and you do the other. You don't neglect taking a bath, and you don't neglect cooking, and you don't neglect chanting, and you don't neglect your children, and you don't neglect things. You manage your time well, but they're all for Krishna. And you don't have it down yet how to do all those things for Krishna, but you continue. Yeah. You know, the theme of your question is, it rings somewhat similar. It's kind of like, how do I go from where I am to where I want to be, and I'm not there yet? That liminal space topic. And you just, you know what the method, there's the process and there's the goal, and you stay with the process as best you can. With faith and good association, including through sound, if you don't have the other kind. Okay.
Thank you.
Prabhupada ki jai. Ah! Okay. One more.
Excuse me, Maharaj. Maharaj, like, in India with my parents and uncle, aunties and brothers, right, I want to share this Krishna consciousness. Like, here I am in the association, I am learning, like, how to do the chanting, and in the association, we are attending Bhakti Virucha and all those things. But they do not have that facility over there, or otherwise, I can also...
Reading group.
Okay. So, my request is, Maharaj, like, for the elders, right, what I can tell them, like, one thing which they can start doing...
Reading. I mean, maybe elders will like chanting, but probably elders will be more inclined to reading and then chanting. Because when you read, you'll hear about the importance of chanting. They have time. It's just their lives have been filled up with stuff. So, you know, there's no room for anything other than stuff because their lives are filled up with stuff. But if you ask them to read, they'll read. And then the little light will go on. Because it's true. It's there's light in Prabhupada's teachings. And they'll have questions and doubts and stuff. But yes, read.
Sure, Maharaj.
Shakti. Vishuddha. Okay. Prabhupada ki jai.
Jai. Jai.